Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First up is PaulKit. Did I say it right? PaulKit. Policy. Yeah, PaulKit. Policy Kit is what it means. PaulKit is how it is spelt. Policy Kit is a reinvention of, or you could say an iteration of, or an expansion of traditional Unix privileges in a way. Don't panic, we're not changing Unix yet. But PaulKit recognizes that a lot of modern Linux users, BSD users, use a GUI desktop. This is a project fostered by the Free Desktop Organization. So you can go to, I think, paulkit.freedesktop.org, I think, and read more about it. The best way to read about it, though, honestly, is doc.opensuse.org/documentation/leap/security/HTML/book-security/CHA-security-PaulKit.html. They've got great documentation on it. I mean, they explain it so well. And basically, to sum it up, you know, traditionally on Linux, if you want to do something that is considered system-wide, then you need to be root user. And then someone came along and said, okay, well, that's a little bit much. Let's stop requiring people to just drop to root all the time and instead give them like this sort of little doorway called sudo, S-U-D-O. They could just use sudo to temporarily grant themselves root privileges to do a thing. So that worked pretty well for a while. But then you may have run into this at one point in your life if you've been using Linux for a while. Sometimes you might start something or you might need to start an application. You might need to do something as root, but you need to do it through your GUI. So for instance, maybe you need to edit a configuration file in /etc. Well, what do you do? Well, you can do sudo space emacs /etc/myconfig, and that'll launch an Emacs session as a sudo user. If you don't have sudo on your system, though, if you could drop down to like, you could just become root and maybe do that in the terminal or something. It's complex because the GUI belongs to your user, and if you then drop to root and try to do things within the GUI, it doesn't always work out because the environment is completely different. There are ways around it. There are things that happen that can make certain, you know, you can change the environment, you can make it happen. It is often not the smoothest of experience. And in some cases, at one point, it was, I don't want to say impossible, but I mean, it was worth logging out and logging back in as root for a moment to do a thing. So that the GUI side of computing and the simple, I just want to run a command with root privileges, those two things were kind of clashing. And PaulKit helps smooth that out really, really drastically. PaulKit developers write XML policy files, and they identify things that within their application might need, you know, privileged access. And then they define whether that aspect of their application ought to be accessible by non-privileged users, even though there's some component of this thing that's running as a privileged user. I mean, a really sort of obvious use case for, or maybe not a full use case, but for example, a virtual machine. Libvirt is running on your system, you're running a virtual machine. Well, as far as Libvirt knows, this is a super privileged process. Like, this is a root process that normal users, they don't have access to the engine. They get to run their virtual machines, but they don't get to just like change the definition of their virtual machines themselves. They don't get to stop the entire virtualization environment. I mean, what if there are other users on the system using things? That would just, you can't do that. That would be a disaster for somebody. So, PaulKit. Now, you can look at all the different PaulKits available, or the policies, rather, available by typing in pk action. And that'll take up your entire screen, so you might want to do pk action pipe to less or more or most, whatever you use. And then it lists a bunch of things. org.freedesktop.udisks2.loopsetup, org.gnome.gconf.defaults.setmandatory, org.libvert.api.secret.delete, things like that. Like I say, lots of stuff here that, you know, you can just kind of imagine, like, what if we just gave anybody access to these things? Or, you know, what if we didn't give people access to these things? So pk action dash a, well, let's find out what that means. Dash dash help. Pk action dash dash action dash id, and then the name of something that you've seen in your list of pk action. So for instance, let's look at org.freedesktop.udisks.cancel-job-others. That seems like something we probably wouldn't want everyone to be able to do. And then to see the actual detailed information, you do need to do dash dash verbose. Okay, so that's pk action dash dash action dash id org.freedesktop.udisks.cancel-job-others space dash dash verbose. And that gives you all the information about this policy. It says the description: cancel a job initiated by another user. Message: authentication is required to cancel a job initiated by others. Vendor: the UDisks project. Vendor: Earl, udisks.freedesktop.org. Icon: drive-removable-media. Implicit: any no. Implicit: inactive no. Implicit: active auth underscore admin. I don't know what half of that means, but I think you probably get the gist of it. The message here is that in order to cancel a job initiated by another user within a, you know, someone else's virtual machine, you do need to authenticate as root. That is not a privilege we're going to grant just anybody. We do want to ensure that people can do that if they have the privileges, but we don't want to just let anybody do that just because they're impatient for a job to finish, or they feel like someone else is taking up too much CPU time or whatever. That's an example of a policy. There are lots of other policies. I mean, PK action, as I said, that'll show you all of them, and you can kind of look through a bunch of those. And so when you're on the desktop and you try to do a thing that requires higher permissions, you don't have to log out of your desktop, log back in as root, launch the application. You know, that's not what you have to do. You don't have to drop down to a terminal and switch over to root and then figure out pgrep and try to get to the button essentially that you want to push as root. And that might literally not be something that you can do without logging out and logging back in as root. So Polkit makes that theoretically possible until it doesn't, in which case it's likely an intentional omission, and that is part of the advice of using Polkit as a developer. Don't provide permissions to something that you don't intend people to get to, you know, because I mean, I imagine there's temptation for a developer to just, well, I've got Polkit here, I should make everything available to anyone with the correct or the desired privileges. But if you don't see why a regular user would need access to a thing, then don't provide that. It feels wrong to even say it, as a user to say it. It just feels wrong. Like, what? Why are you limiting my access to an application that I own, that I've compiled myself? Well, it isn't that. Obviously, you can always run it as root and do whatever you want to. But it doesn't make sense for you to be able to do something that, under the expected use case of that application, you don't need to elevate your privileges to do this thing. You just do it as a user. That's what the application is for. Next on the list is Poppler. Poppler, P-O-P-P-L-E-R. I for the longest time thought this was Poplar, P-O-P-L-A-R, like the tree, I think. Is that how you spell Poplar? I don't really know. But I thought it was a reference to the tree. I guess it's not. It's something else. There's a link from the poplar.freedesktop.org page about why they chose the name, and it links to something, some Wikipedia article about a Futurama episode or something, but I'm sure Poplar predates that, but maybe Futurama is older than I realized. Either way, Poplar is a PDF rendering library. I guess it was developed for XPDF, but it can be used by other things and indeed is. Certainly off the top of my head, Inkscape uses Poplar to import PDFs. So when I say that it's a PDF rendering library, what does that mean? It means, oh, actually, you know what? Here's a non-exhaustive list of programs that use Poplar. So Events, for the GNOME PDF viewer, I think. Ocular, that's definitely the KDE PDF viewer. Probably my favorite PDF viewer that I'm aware of. ePDF View, never heard of it. Loco PDF, never heard of it. GIMP, heard of it. Q All-in-One, haven't heard of that one. QPDF View, I may have used that before. So those are using the Poplar library through some kind of API, some other sort of, well, what language or what framework are you using it through? So for instance, Events uses glib, which Poplar provides an API for. Ocular and Q All-in-One and QPDF View, as you might guess, use the Qt 5 specifically. API to Poplar. GIMP doesn't use a front end for Poplar, it just uses Poplar. ePDF View uses glib, and so on. Okay, so PDF rendering library, what that means is, well, something's gotta like decode the PDF, right? I mean, a PDF is, if we imagine it, we could say it's a very, very strict and very precise, ideally, version of, let's just say this is not true, but let's just say it arbitrarily because it's a language most of us can probably speak. It's HTML, except for paper, right? I mean, it's not. It isn't at all like that. If you've ever looked at the internals of PDF, you would groan at me saying, at me daring to make it seem similar to HTML. It's nothing like HTML. HTML is far superior. But HTML doesn't have any sense necessarily of strict boundaries. HTML tries to fill space. It is meant for the screen specifically. HTML doesn't really ever know that it's going to be printed. And I think in my world, at least, it feels like HTML is probably rarely printed. Whereas PDFs, it was called a pre-flight application at one point in its life. It was meant as a sort of a very fancy and very precise preview of what you were going to get out of your printer after you pressed print on some fancy desktop design application like Quark Express, which probably still exists, Adobe InDesign, or for us open source folk, Scrivis. That's what PDF is designed to do. So it is very strict. It is very, not strict, it is very precise, meaning if you've got a box, a text box, that is meant to be exactly 150 centimeters wide. Well, obviously your screen doesn't know what that means, but the paper does. That matters for paper. So when we render a PDF, we need to make sure that we decide what portion of the screen is 0 centimeters and how far across the screen then is 150 centimeters. And that depends on how much we're zoomed in and all these other things. No matter what, though, we need to make sure that that box goes from 0 to 150 centimeters every single time. And the text inside of that box needs to be within that box, padded by some amount of picos or millimeters or however you want to measure it, every single time, proportionate to everything else. And we also need to make sure that that text is in the font that the designer, the producer of the PDF, has specified. And because PDF is just a kitchen sink format where you can do whatever you want, PDF you can embed fonts into a PDF file. So your PDF renderer, the thing that's drawing it on the screen and making sure that that box is 0 to 150 centimeters based on the zooming amount and the resolution of your screen, making sure that the text is within that box, making sure that the text is a certain font, that library needs to understand how to understand the font inclusion in a PDF and how to use that font, and it needs to be able to substitute that font if if that font is not on your system and is not embedded in the PDF. All kinds of things like that need to be figured out by something. And instead of every single person who wants to render a PDF on your screen visually, instead of every single developer trying to figure out how to do all that, just use Poplar instead. So poplar.freedesktop.org, that's the website. Go there now. Oh, and I forgot, Poplar. So there's Polkit and Polkit Gnome and Polkit Qt. I was supposed to mention this before going straight into Poplar. Polkit Gnome is, you know, the Gnome specific stuff for Polkit. Polkit Qt is the Qt stuff for Polkit. And then there was Poplar. Okay. So, and then there's Poplar Data, which consists of encoding files. So things specific to languages that aren't the default language of Poplar, which would be English probably. I haven't looked, but I'm assuming that that's probably the default. So if you need specialized linguistic support and stuff, Poplar Data would probably be the place that would include all that stuff. Now let's talk about Popt, P-O-P-T. P-O-P-T is, I don't know what the P stands for in the at the front, but think about, maybe it means parse, options, O-P-T, O-P-T, options. P, maybe parse options. Anyway, Popt is indeed a C library to parse options, or to parse command parameters, the arguments that you put after a command. So, for instance, if you do a foo dash dash help, then dash dash help is an argument, an option. Dash o, that's an option. Now, all those options get passed into a C program under the umbrella of arg v and arg c, the arg count and the arguments themselves. They get ingested by the C application, like the C, your C application, and this isn't just for C. Most applications that you can run from a terminal, most programming languages, they expect that when you issue the command that launches that application, that there might be some arguments afterwards. And this is true of more applications than you may even realize. So for instance, in a terminal, if you type in dolphin, for instance, on a Plasma desktop, dolphin dash dash help, that's a legitimate command. Like your terminal will give you a help menu or a help list of options available for the Dolphin file manager, interestingly. So you can do this as, for instance, you could do dolphin dash dash split and then hit return, and you get the a dolphin window in its split mode. That actually didn't work on my system. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. I can pretend like it did, but it didn't. It brought up the previous window that I had opened, but it didn't do it in a split view. Let's try something different. Let's try dolphin dash dash select. The files and folders passed as arguments will be selected. Okay, how about music with a capital M, and then maybe a tilde to make it go to my home? I don't know if that's going to work. It brought me to slash home. Okay, can I tell it where to go? Sorry, I'm getting kind of distracted at this point. None of this matters. Okay, so anyway, there are lots of applications with that just read in the things that you type in after the application, and that you just get that for free. That's just what a programming language and a terminal, that's how they interact. But what do you do with that information? That's the question, because you can do like echo hello and it spits back hello at you, but how did the author of echo know to sort of provide you with the word hello and not, well, here's a great echo help. It just echoes help. Echo dash dash help, and it echoes dash dash help. Like, how is that happening? How does the author of this program know sort of not to take what you've given it even if it looks like an option, and return it to you instead of erroring out and saying, hey, I don't know what that option means. Or for that matter, how does any application know that you've given it an option and what to do with that option? Well, someone has to parse the strings of text that you send to that application. And the parsing is done, you know, in the source code, in some block of code designed to parse options. And there are lots of different ways to do this. You can do this manually. You can write your own rules and just say, well, hey, look, if you see two dashes then and no space, then whatever's after those two dashes is a long option. If you see a single dash and a letter, then that's a short option. And if there's a space or an equal sign, then that's the argument to the option. Unless it's a space and another dash, then that's a new option. You know, so you can do the logic and figure it out, but there are libraries such as Popt to do this for you. Now, Popt man page is very, very good. If you do man popt, it tells you what it does and really kind of like how it does it, and it's a really good read. It is probably about, I don't know, 10 screenfuls of reading. So let's call it 7, 10 pages, whatever, of text. But a lot of that, a good chunk of that, like about 2 screenfuls on my monitor. It's about, let's call it 100 and, no, not 100, and let's call that 60 lines of text. There is a sample application. So I'm going to, I mean, you can look at it and you can kind of get the feel for how Popt works. I am just going to do a man popt and redirect that output into a file called man popt .c. And I'm just going to remove everything but the example. I'm not going to read the whole example out. If it was a short example, I would, but it's quite long. It is, now that I've got it in the text editor, I can tell you exactly. It's 85 lines as included in the man page. So that is with all the white space and all the comments and stuff like that. But you kind of, we'll just kind of briefly include popt.h and standard.io.h. Void usage. Okay, so usage. This is their help menu, I'm assuming. And it's popt print usage. Okay, yep. F print standard error quote percent sign colon percent s zero comma error comma addle. Call me crazy, but I think there's a missing quote there, right? Because if it's a standard error, fprint, standard error, quote percent s colon percent s zero comma, there should be a quote after the zero, right? Yes, absolutely. You can't, yeah. So there's a missing quote. I just piped it in from the man page, so I'm finding it really hard to believe that that is true, but it's actually true. I should probably jot this down so that I can email the author. I don't know if this is that important, but I mean, seems like someone ought to know about that. Exit. That's another error. You can't have exit without standard lib, I don't think. I'm pretty sure we need to include standard lib. Okay, so include popt.h. I'm getting nervous about this example now. I'm on line 8, and I have found 2 errors. So include popt.h, include standard.io.h, and now hash include space bracket standard lib, stdlib dot h, bracket, angle bracket, and we've got our quote. Okay. Now we should be good to go. So int main int arg c, this is what I was talking about, car arg v, and then the whole array of whatever we've typed. It's defining some different things for argument parsing. Car c int I equals 0, car port name. Okay, so port name is going to be an option in here. Int speed equals 0, raw equals 0. Int j, car buff, buff size plus 1, popped context, opt con. Struct, creating a struct. So I think this is the, this is going to be the content. These are the options being defined, BPS or B. So dash dash BPS dash B, signaling rate in bits per second. CRNL. I'm not reading every bit of code, so I'm kind of abbreviating. There's a bunch of stuff in here that I'm just kind of skimming. CRNL or C, so that it'll be a dash dash CRNL or a dash C. Expand CR characters to CR/LF sequences. I don't know if it actually does any of this, or is this all just, you know, FUBAR Greek. HW flow H. So that'll be something to look for. No flow in raw .r, SW flow software flow control, port auto help. Okay, so here's something interesting, right? So we know that in the int main definitions, we've got something called port name, car port name. But I am noticing that it is not, there's nothing about a port in the options. So I believe we're going to experience that the options we will see should be BPS, CRNL, HW, all the ones that I just said. And then the leftover option, the thing that we don't parse, or well, we'll parse it, but the thing that doesn't get defined anywhere else becomes the port name. So that's the leftover argument, essentially. And that's an important thing to account for if you're writing your own parsing algorithm, which you can do. I do it in Bash. I do it the Patrick Volkerding method, where you just list, you do an if-else loop. Well, if-else-if break loop, where you catch everything that you can possibly catch. You shift to the next argument. You go back up to the top, catch everything you can catch, shift, and so on until you run out. And then you just dump everything left over into an array or into a variable and assume that that's the thing that that's the thing that didn't get defined anywhere else. Therefore, it must be the thing that we're operating on or you know, whatever. You kind of, it's sort of the one thing without an option must be the thing that we're, you know, normally processing. Okay, so that's that was the options, the valid options being defined within a struct. Then there's a while loop, and it says now do option processing get port name. Cool. While c equals popped get next opt is greater than or equal to 0, then we look through this thing, and we're just looking for a case of c, a case of h, a case for s, a case of n. Those should all sound vaguely familiar, and they are, because those are things that are defined as options in the struct. So we're catching those options, and then what's left over is the port name. So port name equals popped get arg opt con. If port name equals null, or if it popped peak arg opt con, I don't know what any of that means, equals null, then the usage, we trigger the usage and we say specify a single port, e.g. dev CUA0. Okay, so again, I don't know if this is even for real or what, but that should trigger. If we don't provide a port name, then skimming this code at least, we should get sort of a message saying, hey, here's how to use this command. If an error occurred during the option parsing, do something else, and then print out the options and the port name chosen. Okay, so yeah, this is all fake. So print F, so it's gonna tell you, it'll tell us what options we told it, so it's a bit of a very overcomplex echo command, essentially, and print the port name that you chose to create. Cool. All right, so with those changes made, I think there's a possibility that this could work. We do need to compile it, as you do. So we'll do GCC dash L to include the library, POPT. GCC knows where to find POPT. I've told it dash L, so it's going to look in the library directories of my system, of my operating system as defined by package config or something, /manpop.c, and then -o, we'll just call it manpop. Okay, so now we got warnings. Did get two warnings that I didn't, I guess, you know, there's something here that I didn't catch, but it did compile. These are just warnings. I think I'm just gonna ignore those warnings right now. I've already fixed two bugs. I don't need to worry about the warnings as well. And I'm gonna do a /manpopped with no arguments. And luckily, it provides usage. It says, here's the usage. Man popped, and then it tells me the different options that are available to me. The different options are -b or --bps equals bps, a -c or --crnl, -h, --hwflow. I don't love using the -h for something that isn't help, but I guess it can't be helped. -n for no flow, --no flow, -r, -raw, -s, --swflow, --?, or --help. And then --usage, which of course gives us this message here. And then square brackets options, close square brackets, asterisk, bracket, port, close bracket. Okay, let's just do man popped, and then we'll do, I don't know, localhost. Options chosen is blank, port name chosen, localhost. man./manpopped hello world, same thing, no options, but a port name has been defined. Okay, great. Well, let's do /manpopped --bps equal sign 877 megahertz. Let's just do that. And then -c for the crnl thing, and then hello world. So it says, oh no, I didn't like that. Okay, so it says usage is bps, port, specify a single port such as this one thing. Okay, so what it really wanted was the bps to just be an integer. So --bps equals 877-c hello world gives me feedback that the options chosen was -c and -b877, port name chosen, hello world. Can I add something after hello world? Let's try --raw. Yes, I can do that. So options chosen -c-r-b877, port name chosen, hello world. And on, you can do that all day. Nothing will happen. It's just a fake application that doesn't actually do anything. But it does demonstrate how through popped, you get a lot of sort of built-in functions. I don't want to say for free, because I mean, it's 85 lines of code just for this silly demonstration. But do you have to parse, do you have to write your own parser? No, you don't. And that's huge. That's a big deal. It's not that big of a deal in Bash. It's a huge deal in C. It's even a huge, I mean, honestly, it's a huge deal in Lua, in Python, in Java, in all the application, all the programming languages, where you're suddenly all of your assumptions get thrown out because they don't exist, especially in C. I mean, that doesn't assume anything. It assumes that it's got data, and you'd better tell what kind of data it is, because it doesn't even know that much. So using pops, using a parsing library makes it so much easier to just interact with your user. Help your user interact with your application. That's P-O-P-T, popped. It is now time for coffee. Let's go get a cup of coffee. We'll come back and I think actually just get through the P section. I think we'll be done with this section. So let's do that. Go. I'm back with not coffee, but Crave. No, actually, it is coffee. I mean, but the coffee is called Crave. This is a blend. No, not a blend. A roast. It is a bag of coffee beans from a company called Hummingbird Coffee. Free trade organic coffee. This is kind of the, this is, for me, probably totally incorrectly, but for me, this is kind of the quintessential Kiwi, like New Zealand coffee, because it seemed like when I first got to New Zealand, that's all I ever saw was Hummingbird Coffee. I don't believe it has any indication at all over how popular Hummingbird is. It's just, I think that in Wellington, at the volunteer gigs that I would attend, they happened to have gotten Hummingbird, probably because it's fair trade and they've probably defaulted to that. And it was fine. It was great. It's weird in New Zealand. It's weird to me anyway. At events, at smallish events, I guess, you'll find that they don't tend to have coffee. Like in the States, if I go to an event, I typically think there's going to be coffee. I mean, that's just, I don't know, that's often, I mean, an event of a certain kind, right? I mean, like a volunteer thing that you're doing, or a tech conference, or a game conference, or whatever you're going to, like certain places that kind of have like the little plate of nibbles or the refreshments. Coffee's a thing in the USA, but in New Zealand, it's actually not. So I think most people expect there to be tea, and coffee is kind of a bonus. And so what I found pretty early on was that most events that I would go to where they would say, you know, like that there's coffee on site or whatever, or refreshments or whatever, that the coffee would be Sanka, or, you know, instant coffee and tea. Or if it wasn't instant coffee, which I refuse to drink instant coffee, like just flat out refuse to drink instant coffee. I mean, I'll have an instant coffee, first of all, if it is literally the only option. You know, you just put a bunch of milk and sugar and just have like a coffee flavored, whatever that would be. So, you know, that's maybe, but I don't think of that as coffee. That's like, well, it's a compromise is what that is. And it's not a great one either. But so if they don't have the instant stuff, which is, you know, fortunate, then for whatever reason, again, it seems like they had Hummingbird. So for me, when I see Hummingbird, and it's a kind of a distinctive bag, so I see it and I think, oh, that's New Zealand's coffee. Again, probably completely wrong and completely influenced just by a weird coincidence that this one place I went to that one time had Hummingbird, and this other place that I went to another time had Hummingbird. And because it was within the first month of me even living in New Zealand at all, I suddenly thought that, okay, everyone's got Hummingbird coffee. But it is, as it turns out, very good coffee. This one is called Crave, which, I mean, that's such a, is it a cologne or is it a coffee? Why not both? Crave, it's a great name for coffee. And it feels like a bold name, but it's actually not that bold of a coffee, really, not compared to the other stuff that I had, which I've already, Mahia, something like that. The other stuff. Anyway, I think I have a little bit of that other stuff left over, and then I'm gonna, so I'll finish the Crave, then the Mahia, and then I've got some new coffee from a new place that I went to over this past weekend. I don't have a whole lot of hope for it. I think it's gonna be pretty average, but we'll find out probably in, I don't know, two episodes from now. Okay, so there's more stuff to go over. Obviously, we're still in the P section. We've gotten through Popped. Now we're on to Pulse Audio. Pulse Audio is the sort of default sound system for Linux right now. Of course, in the previous episode, we were talking about, was it the previous or the one before that? One of those two, talking about Pipewire and how it is all but displacing Pulse Audio. Did some further testing with Pipewire since that episode, and I have run into some minor issues with certain hardware. It's touch and go, hard to pin down, but yeah, I might be switching back to Pulse Audio, or I might just be updating Pipewire. We'll find out when I get around to bothering it with it. But anyway, Pulse Audio, that's the thing. It's been around since about, I don't know, let's call it Fedora 7 or 8 or 9. Very early when I was switching to Linux back in 2006, 2007, 2008, that time frame. So this was, I think this was probably 2009-ish. Pulse Audio, I mean, I could probably look it up on Wikipedia or something. Pulse Audio was kind of like, it was being rolled out. And it was, I mean, it took a while to get to Slackware. I remember, I really, really remember not having Pulse Audio. And it was, as I said in the Pipewire episode, it was not great. Pulse Audio hit, and initially there were problems. People were discovering all of the problems. And I feel like people got, a lot of people got really sort of a bad taste for Pulse Audio from that experience. And that it was one of those things that felt a little bit of an overreaction to me. I felt like people were really, really against Pulse Audio, even though, because it changed something, and what had worked before was no longer working. And so it seemed like not a benefit to them, which is an understandable complaint. I don't know the right answer for, no, I do know the right answer for this. The right answer is for there to be a distribution out there that has the cutting edge technology, call it, I don't know, Fedora. And then there should be another distribution out there that champions stability and doesn't switch to the new technology until the new technology has all but proven itself. And that's the answer, but that's not what we as Linux users have agreed on, because what we have instead is like this cutting edge distribution, I don't know, call it Fedora, and then this other distribution that sort of is also kind of actually pretty cutting edge, call it Ubuntu. And then you've got other distributions that kind of do things whenever they get around to it, and other ones that, you know, so I don't know. I feel like people got a bad taste for Pulse Audio because frankly, I don't think that the distributions are being, you know, we're not managing that, the rollout well. We're just kind of including stuff based on possibly a little bit of competition, based on maybe excitement for new technology, the very real necessity of getting new technology into a distribution and getting it tested and working and so on. So there's a lot of kind of weird, bad feelings about Pulse Audio that are historical, I think, just based on, I think it was down to a bad rollout, essentially. That's how I feel. Unfortunately, I don't know who to talk to at the open source offices to get a better rollout next time. I think Pipewire is blessed with the privilege of being a replacement for an existing technology. That means people can roll it out when they feel like it's ready, because it's not going to add that much new stuff, right? It's just replacing the old stuff. And I do wonder if there's something there in sort of open source practice that says, if you're a brand new technology, just be on guard, because people are going to hate you. You're going to change something. You're making something different. People are going to hate you. But your successor, the thing that changes you because you now work, but you're just being neglected, your successor, man, people are going to love that. Maybe it's more than open source. Maybe that's just how the world works. I'm not sure. But Pulse Audio, brand new sort of concept. It was a sound server. And that's a little bit of a complex concept to understand, or it's a complex concept to understand why that's a good thing. Pulse Audio has the ability of accepting inputs and outputs and signals, and it has the ability then to put it into to put all of these things into pipelines. It can accept music from a Firefox browser and from your music player, and direct those streams of audio to the output stream. And then on your desktop, you can direct that output stream to your speakers or to your earphone. And now you've got music and sound from your Firefox browser playing at the same time over the same device. Also wasn't able to do that. It didn't have this concept of what I'm calling pipelines. Pulse Audio calls them syncs and streams, I think. Syncs and streams, or syncs and sources, something like that. It's a little bit confusing, although you do need to, input and output is a little bit of a simplistic view for audio, so you can't, it's better not to call things input and output, although ultimately that is kind of what it is. But anyway, Pulse Audio has this concept and a layer of abstraction because it's running on top of ALSA. It's running and accepting inputs and outputs or sinks and sources or something. And it can combine those and mix them and then send them to your speaker so you can hear both at the same time. ALSA can't do that. It can accept a stream and it can grab a device and plug them together, and that's it. Those things are now together, and you cannot interrupt. You can't insert something into that connection. Like, that's done. That is a connection that is made. If you want to use that output device, you need to unplug the one thing, plug the other thing in. I guess you could even say Pulse Audio is a Y adapter. It's one of those little cables that has one plug on one end, and then two ports on the other end. That's what Pulse Audio is. I don't think there's a whole lot of there's no reason really to get further into Pulse Audio. I mean, that's Pulse Audio. Are you using Pulse Audio? PACTL. What is it? Info, I think. Type that in, and it'll tell you the server name. Now, right now, my server name is Pulse Audio on Pipewire 0.3.44. So, yes, I'm sort of using Pulse Audio, but actually, I'm using Pipewire with like a Pulse Audio module or something like that. So I don't know. Am I using Pulse Audio? I'm not sure. I believe I'm using Pipewire. Well, I am using Pipewire. I believe what it's doing is faking. It's pretending like it's Pulse Audio. That's what I kind of understand. And Pipewire largely does that. I mean, it's a drop-in replacement for Pulse Audio. So it isn't meant to be drastically unique from Pulse Audio, or it is in many ways, but it's meant to satisfy the exact same requirements as Pulse Audio and then whatever else it's doing. So PACTL is a command that comes with Pulse Audio. PA Pulse Audio. You'll find a lot of the Pulse Audio commands are PA something. So PA control, PA cuddle, PACTL is the sort of a direct controller for Pulse Audio. So if you do PACTL-H or --help, you get all the different commands that are available to you, like PACTL status, and that'll tell you what's in use right now and what Pulse Audio is up to. PACTL info gives you a rundown on what Pulse Audio you're running, like what the server name is and what the server version is and the default sample specification and all these other things. PACTL exit, I don't know, it probably exits Pulse Audio maybe, I'm not sure. Okay, I don't know what exit does. List, upload sample, play sample, remove sample, load module, unload module. That's stuff to remember. I was talking in two episodes ago about Pipewire, how it had echo cancellation. There's a Pulse Audio module for echo cancellation, but Pipewire has it just built in, so that's convenient. And then you can do Pulse Audio control, like move a sync input or a source output, get a sync, get a source, or get sync, or source, you know, volume, or mute that sync or source. So if you see the option in, what is this one? PAVU control, PAVUCTL, or just, I guess it's PAVU now. It's the volume control, which I don't even know how to get there, honestly. I go to my application menu and just type in PAVU, and it comes up with Pulse Audio Volume. I guess that's what it's called, Volume Center, Volume Control. If you see it in there, you can basically do it with PA Control. And that's a good one to look at, PAVU Control or Pulse Audio Volume Control, whatever. That's a good application to look at to kind of sort of somewhat visualize Pulse Audio and what it thinks your system is like. There's a bunch of tabs across the top. There's the playback, the recording, the output devices, and input devices, which notably are different than playback and recording. I think we tend to think of a very direct relationship between like that speaker there and an output device. And while that's true for that one, there may be something else that does both. You know, something that does like a Well, certainly my headphones. It's got an input device, the microphone, and an output device, which are, a source and a sink, which are the actual speakers in the headphones. And then there's configuration, and that one kind of just lists everything that it knows exists on your system in terms of audio, and kind of tells you the profile that it's using. So does it consider it an analog stereo output device, or is it actually an analog stereo output plus a mono input, or is it something else, analog stereo input, whatever. So that's not a bad thing to take a look at if you're still running Pulse, which, I mean, I'm not saying if you're still running Pulse, like judgmentally, I'm just saying if you are running Pulse, that's something to look at. And I mean, frankly, you can look at it with Pipewire as well. Again, Pipewire is running in a Pulse audio mode, so it a lot of the Pulse audio tools just look at Pipewire and can kind of tell you what it thinks your system is like. And if you look in there and see a bunch of discrepancies, then it might be worth switching back to Pulse, if you're on Pipewire. Or if you're on Pulse and you see discrepancies, maybe investigate why. A lot of times it's not a discrepancy, it's just a confusing way of expressing something. So, I mean, also Mixer, that always lists five different speakers that aren't even attached to my system. And it drives me just so much information, so much information. Pulse, at least it tells me like what it can actually use right now. It's kind of refreshing. Pipewire, still getting used to. Sometimes it tells me what I can use, sometimes it tells me twice of the things that I can use or not the thing that I want to use. So it's tough. It's really, really, it's a complex system, and I feel like Pulse has really, really made it a lot easier to just sort of understand sound on a Linux system. Is it perfect? No, I guess not, because Pipewire has a bunch of cool new features that Pulse Audio, yeah, kind of can do if you fiddle around with it enough, but Pipewire can do it easier, like routing sound internally and so on. So I'm a big fan of Pipewire, but I gotta say, Pulse Audio in the, 10 years of its 10 plus 12, 14 years of its kind of like reign, I think it did a really good job and is doing a good job of really making this the complexity of sound on a computer quite manageable. And some people are hearing that and they're just saying, well, that's not my experience. Like sound on computers, sound on Linux, sound on open source, blah blah blah. But I just I don't I understand that it's complex, and I'm acknowledging that it's complex, but at the same time, like, it's something that if you sit down and learn, then you can get really good at it. So it isn't a deficiency of the software with Pulse Audio. With also, it's a deficiency. There are some things with also you simply cannot do. And that bothered me. Like that really, really bugs me. And I wouldn't want to be on a system with just ALSA. That is not enough for me. That is a deficiency. Pulse, you can do everything that you need, and then some fancy stuff. You might have to load a module or something and make a fake sound device, and then like use the monitor of that fake device as your input. Bunch of hacks, right? But Pipewire, at least on the trajectory that it is right now, appears to be aiming towards where you don't even have to really do the hacks. You just get the functions, and that's fantastic. Okay, that's enough about Pulse, because I said I wanted to get through the P section, and I'm not through it, and I'm almost out of time. So Pulse Audio, that's done, done, done. PyCairo is obviously a Python library, or more specifically, it's Python bindings for the Cairo graphics library. And this kind of thing, I'm not going to go through every single one in this list because there's a bunch of them, but this is the kind of thing that is just really exciting. This is one reason I think that Python is as popular as it is, because this is the kind of thing where this gives you power that you quote unquote shouldn't have. So, PyCairo bindings. What is a binding? Well, a binding is basically a translation. There is a C library out there for Cairo. We've talked about it in the past. It's a graphics library. It helps you draw stuff on screen. Well, if you don't know C, Cairo is not useful to you at all. Oh, wait, unless you know Python. Because thanks to these Python bindings, you can type Python and it'll go through it'll use the PyCairo module that you've installed on your system, or that you have, in this case, installed on your system, and it will talk to the C library on your behalf, it being this library, this PyCairo library. It will trigger the C library on your behalf. You've talked Python, it translates your speech into C, and you get the pretty graphics on your screen. There's a great little demo application on the opening page of PyCairo. It's pycairo.readthedocs.io. You'll see the demo application. Copy and paste it. Check it out. Now, it only saves your results to an SVG. It doesn't like pop up on your screen. It is a very short example, so it isn't, you know, it's not going to be visually exciting at first. But if you copy and paste that into my demo.py, and then run it, you'll get an example.svg. You'll open it up. You'll see a little Bezier curve. Is that exciting? I mean, yeah, actually it is. You're drawing graphics with code with a really nice library, Cairo, but you're just writing Python. Same thing goes for PyCups. Well, not exactly the same thing. PyCups, of course, is the Python bindings for the Cups API, the Cups API being the common Unix printing system. PyGObject, same deal. These are Python bindings for Gobject, Gobject 3, PyGTK, same deal. You wanted to use GTK library? Well, you can't. Oh, wait, yes, you can if you know Python. PyParsing, PyParsing is. PyParsing module is an alternative approach to creating and executing simple grammars, such as, like you might have done with, like, Lex and Yak, which we've talked about a long time ago now. That was a long time ago, Lex and Yak. But yeah, there's PyParsing. Python Jinja 2, that's a templating system. So Jinja is a way for you to write kind of simplified, well, templates, I guess, you know, simplified versions of something that you want in the end. And then you send stuff to, you know, you apply your template to data, and you open up whatever destination. Usually it's, in my experience, usually it's HTML. Maybe that's the only one, I don't know. But you open that up, and then suddenly you've got a fully populated document. It's a really nice system, Jinja 2. I used to kind of shy away from it because it felt very abstract. Like, well, why do I need to learn Jinja 2 in order to just do this simple HTML thing? Well, you don't. But if you do, then you can do more complex HTML things. I don't use Jinja too much anymore. I used to. And I use things that are inspired by it in my bash script that I use to post this podcast. And by inspired by, I mean, very, very barely inspired by, but still, I mean, templating is great. It's a very important thing. Python Markup Safe, it's a library to keep text objects, you sort of to avoid really obvious sort of, you know, little mistakes when people say, I don't know, Python reboot, you know, and Python thinks, oh, it's time to reboot the computer now. Well, I meant Python quote reboot, not that Python reboot would actually reboot your system, but you know what I mean? Like, you type something and it gets expanded as a command or something, instead of being considered as just some text. It's a very important principle to keep in mind. Python PyYAML. PyYAML parses YAML. We've talked about YAML before. Python apdirs, this is a module for determining the platform appropriate directories. So if you need, like, the user's data directory, what does that mean? On Linux, it might mean tilde, or, you know, $home/, no, that would be it, $home. Whereas on Windows, it might be C:// documents, my documents. I don't know how that works. And so on. Python certify. That's a library to keep track of all those little root certificates on your system, which could be important for your, you know, your beautiful soup application that needs to connect to a web server and verify that it's the correct server. Python CFFI, that's the C foreign function interface. And as that name suggests, it is a method of using C, you know, functions from C within your Python. And there's a thing called, what is it, Cython, C-Y-T-H-O-N, that kind of plays in the same space. But this is, I mean, this is almost like that one, what is it, os.shell function in Python, where you just kind of drop out of Python for a moment and you just run a shell command. This is kind of, you drop out of Python for a moment and just write some C code and use C libraries, and then you're back in Python doing your thing. So there's, once again, there's example documentation, cffi.readthedocs.io. There's a good little quick example of how this can work. I could read it, but I don't think it's all that interesting. I will say that, you know, if we were judging things on, as they say, how Pythonic it is, I would not say that this feels very Pythonic, meaning that if you were to look at this code as a Python coder with no other coding experience, then you quite likely wouldn't understand what it was doing. I don't think there's that much of a chance that you would understand this code. And I think, you know, I understand why that is the case, but I do believe that is a little bit of, that's something, I guess, just to keep in mind. It would be beautiful if somehow it weren't like that. Like if it was more like, you know, C bindings for every C, for every possible C library for Python. Like if such a magical thing could exist, then that would be cool, is what I'm saying, which, you know, it's not worth a whole lot. I'm just saying, you sometimes, especially Python coders, you hear something and people get very excited about it. Like, oh my gosh, you can do anything in Python. I mean, just think, with CFFI, you can use any C library you'd ever want. And you think, oh my gosh, this sounds great. Python is magic. And then you look at it and you realize, oh, wait, all you've done is given me the ability to basically exit Python in the middle of my code, write C, and then come back to Python. That's kind of all that happens. It's not Pythonic. Okay, that's not a criticism. It's just like the facts. Like this is not this does not look like Python code. This is not Python code. You're not going to be, you know, you have to get out of your Python mindset and write different code, and then you'll be writing Python again. So anyway, Python dash, I don't know how to say this, char-det. It's character detection. Universal encoding detector for Python 2 and 3, char-det.readthedocs.io. It detects what kinds of characters something is giving it. That's what this is. Python char set normalizer. It's a character set normalizer. Python distro probably detects your distro. And this list goes on and on and on for a long time. There's a bunch of different Python modules, and I have decided as of right now that I'm not going to go through them all. That's just too much. Because then we would be talking about Python, and I don't feel like this is necessarily a Python podcast as such. All of these modules are really, really useful for a lot of the different things that you can do with Python, and I think it's probably worth looking at these or not, but I mean, you can look at these and get an idea of all the different spaces that Python can mess around in, and it's just kind of shocking at how much space there is within Python. I mean, it truly, truly does. It's just everywhere. And that's, I mean, as much as I don't like Python, and there are lots of things I don't like about Python, I have done an episode pretty much comparing Lua with Python. And I'm pretty clear on the parts of sort of Python that I don't love. So you can listen to 432, episode 432. You can listen to episode, what is this? Oh, this is 12 X26. 12X26 is my episode about 7 reasons you should be using Lua, and I call Python out on several of these things because I just, you know, I have problems with some portions of Python. So that's 12.26 and 4.32, I think is what I said, for Python stuff. But I think, you know, as much as I dislike Python, I actually like Python even more because Python, honestly, was the first language, computer language, that I really truly wrapped my head around. Like, it really was. Like, Python was my gateway into sort of messing around with programming. I mean, I think, you know, to be fair, I think that Python also taught me a bunch of bad habits that I or maybe Python didn't. The things that I read about how to get started with Python taught me a lot of bad habits that I had to unlearn for lots of other languages. No, I think actually Python did as well. I think Python kind of taught me some bad programming concepts. Or maybe it didn't teach me important good ones. But Python is still, like, no matter how you feel about, like, writing Python, which, I mean, you know, I can think of worse fates for sure than getting to write Python code for a living. Like, that's not, you're doing pretty well. But whether you like it or not, or whether you think it could be better or not, and I mean, there's so much room there, right? I mean, come on, everything can be better, right? So, I mean, yes, I love Python, but it could be better. Great. If that's how you feel, like, Python is everywhere, and it's a beautifully simple and sensible language, and it's great. It really is. It's a beautiful thing. And I think that there are so many Python libraries in here just hiding out on the system, kind of speaks to that. Like, this is why Python is ubiquitous, I guess. Look at all this stuff. We've got a graphics library. We've got, I skipped this one, PyCurl. There's a Python bindings for the curl command. So there's PyCurl. There's PyGobject, PyGTK, which I heard that wasn't really even supported anymore, so I don't know if I'd use that. But anyway, PyYAML, PyAppDirs for OS, you know, system level stuff. Python distro for, again, system level stuff. PyDocUtils for document formatting for your RST documents. Python future, time travel. Python markdown for parsing markdown. Python pillow for image library stuff, like basically image magic or not image magic, but an image processing library, pillow. C parser. Python random, Python setup tools for packaging, Python 6 for migrating your Python 2 code to Python 3, which, by the way, is a really, really useful thing. I've used it on several, I mean, I used it all the time back when 2 was being end-of-lifed, but I still use it today, Py 6. I still use that today to quickly translate a Python 2 to Python 3 application. Doesn't always work, depending on how old that Python 2 application is, or how old really the libraries that it's depending on are. But it very frequently does work, and that's great. Python URL lib and the certify and all these other things for network communication and certification, security, verification. Python 2 module collection. Okay, so that's a lot of stuff. And I think one thing to note is that a lot of these are Python 2 libraries. And it's also important to note, ultimately, that all of these Python libraries here are system libraries. They are being used by stuff that is installed on Slackware. As a Python programmer, whether you're experienced or just learning, as the programmer, you wouldn't be using these libraries. Like, these Python modules, even if they're here, I mean, first of all, it won't be here. These are Python 2 modules. I think universally these are Python 2. I don't believe any of these are Python 3. If they are, they're not marked as such very well. But these are, you wouldn't use these. It is the Python methodology to instead create a virtual environment. And the way that you do that is you go into, you make a directory called demo, for instance. I'm going to go into the demo directory. And now I'm going to do Python 3 dash m for module, venv, and then we'll call venv dot. So we'll just create a virtual environment. That's what the venv stands for, in the current directory, which again, I've created a demo directory so that I didn't pollute my environment for this very reason. And then on top of all that, I would do a source dot slash bin slash slash activate, and then I get my prompt back. But my prompt now is preceded by the word parentheses demo close parentheses, meaning that I am now in my terminal. I am in a virtual environment. I'm in a Python virtual environment, which also means that whenever I type in Python now, I'm actually using the Python version instantiated by this virtual environment. And if I were to do, for instance, a Python 3-m pip install py Cairo, well, it's installing PyCairo, but it's doing it only into this virtual environment. So you're managing your libraries basically on a hyper local level. Like you're doing this here in this virtual environment. And so you can program all you want and test stuff off of these libraries that you've installed, and then package it up and send it to people. And you know, as long as they're also Python, they know how to run Python stuff, then they'll be able to do the same thing. They can do a Python 3-m pip -r setup.txt or whatever, requirements.txt, I think. And then that'll install all their libraries into their virtual environment or onto their computer. And then they'll be using your application with all the libraries that they required, and it'll be the most up-to-date libraries and so on. So in other words, Python has its own package manager. And the intent for Python these days is essentially that you as the developer create an environment, load it up with all the latest versions of the libraries, run your code in that environment, develop in that environment, and then you can send it out into the world pretty sure that you've accounted for every library. Why are you sure? Well, because you've been able to use its package manager to list all of the modules you've loaded into your virtual environment, and that way you know exactly what people need to run your application. At least those are the theories. Now, in practice, how are you really going to manage that? Do you really know that it's going to work on a Windows machine after you've tested it for 8 years on Linux, or 8 days on Linux? Doesn't matter. Like, however sure you are that it's working on Linux, are you really sure it's going to work on Windows or on Mac OS X, 10, whatever they call it now? And who knows? Like, that's one of those things that unfortunately there's still a lot of sort of trial and error around. But in terms of the libraries, that is that virtual environment. You're going to use local libraries, local modules, not the stuff installed on your system. Because if you rely on the stuff that's listed in Slackware slash L directory here, then you might be developing on an old version of that library, which is, in fact, in this case, is very true. You'd be developing off of Python 2. Or you might be developing something and then forget that, oh yeah, I used Python dash markup safe on this, and I never wrote that down anywhere. So now I've got this Python application out there that's not even listing that as a requirement, and it's not working for anybody, or it's working up until a point and then it crashes and I can't figure out why. So the virtual environment sort of concept, the idea that there's a requirements.txt that Python pip can parse and then install the dependencies for, all of that, that's kind of the Python way, and it's cool. It really, really works well when it works well. I mean, it also doesn't work all the time. There are ways for you to break that, like, and it usually involves giving it to someone who just doesn't have any idea that Python exists, doesn't care, doesn't know what they need for this thing to install, and it can get complex, and double that if you're sending it to someone not on the platform that you've developed for. Way around that? Sure, there's lots of ways. One way is to learn Java. And that's it. That's the P section of the L software set, which means that in the next episode, we start on the Q section. So we are getting close. We are getting close to the end of the L's. That's really, really exciting. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.